The Tom Woods Show, episode 2248.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, all you old timers out there from the Ron Paul 2008 campaign, you may remember my friend Larry Lepard, who spent $200,000 of his own money on full-page newspaper ads in support of Dr. Paul. Well, Larry has had an uncanny way with money over the years, and he made a presentation to my paid membership on how to insure yourself against currency debasement. That is to say, how to survive inflation. Well, I took that presentation out from behind the paywall, and I'm making it available to the general public for free. Check it out at tomwoods.com/Larry. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I am delighted to welcome back our old friend, Murray Sabrin. Murray taught finance at Ramapo College in New Jersey for how many years was it, Murray?
35 years, half a lifetime.
Yeah, that's really something. Plus, I also had an interesting political career we'll have an opportunity to talk about. But Murray has a brand new book available to us now, which means only that 4 months must have passed since the last time we talked to Murray Sabrin, because that seems to be the pace at which he's releasing them these days. But a brand new book, it's called From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. So welcome back, Murray.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you now that we're both Florida residents.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct. And I remember, by the way, years ago, I think only I was in Florida and you were visiting, and we ate at Sweet Tomatoes, the salad and soup buffet place, which was a casualty of COVID. The whole chain shut down because of that.
I am so disappointed. We were living in Fort Myers when we moved down here in June of 21, and there was a wonderful Sweet Tomatoes right on Route 41, Tamiami Road, and it closed up. And so COVID did a number on a lot of great places in America, and this is the sad consequences of having top-down healthcare policy.
Oh, geez, yeah, you said it. But at least you're in the best state with the best state surgeon general, so that's something you have going for you. So we're going to talk about your background. Now, you and I have known each other. I don't think we go back quite as far as your New Jersey gubernatorial run, although I may have met you at the Mises Institute by then, but I didn't really know you. I got to know you later on. I know in 2008, you ran for U.S. Senate that year, because I remember I flew up to New York from Auburn, Alabama to speak for you. And then that same day I flew back. I was home in my own bed, sleeping in my own bed that same day. I went up to speak for Murray Sabrin, who, by the way, I'll just say one quick thing before we get into the full story. One great thing about Murray Sabrin, the politician, is that he was never afraid to ask people for money. I can say that. And you got it. I was very happy to donate to Murray Sabrin. I want him out there spreading common sense in New Jersey, where it was in desperate need. But yeah, there was never, you didn't have to convince Murray to ask. He knew that if you want to be successful, you need to have resources like the other people. But your resources were used to spread good rather than destructive ideas. So you came to the U.S. when you were, what, 2.5 years old?
2.5 years old, August 6, 1949.
Okay. So let's start off, though, with a little bit of the background regarding your family and the circumstances of your coming to the U.S. You were born in West Germany.
Right outside of Munich, in a little town that is one of the great spas in the world called Bad Wersofen. And in 1992, my wife and I took a trip to Germany with a friend of ours, a bus tour through East and West Germany. And we went to Munich, but we couldn't get to the town that I was born. I have the original birth certificate my father gave me, so it's still in my files. And there it is, Abraham and Luba Szyprinski and their new son, Moses.
That's you. That's you, Moses.
That's me. That's me.
That?
And so when we came to America, my father's first cousin preceded us to America, and he changed the name from Szyprinski, a good Polish name, to Sabrin, S-A-B-R-I-N. And we took that name. And when I went to second grade in the Bronx, when we moved there in 1953, I saw my student record and Moses was crossed out and Szyprinski was crossed out and Murray Sabrin was put in its place.
So was that the first moment you realized that you'd been born with a different name?
I think so. Again, I'm remembering when I was 5 years old, it's kind of murky now that I'm nearly 76.
Right.
But again, my parents changed my name and I wish they had kept my name. Moses is a pretty unique name today.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of first names, there was a great runner, if you remember from the Olympics, Edwin Moses, who was a great athlete. And
oh, and there was, of course, there was Moses Malone. There was Moses Malone, too.
Absolutely.
Another player, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now we have Moses Sabrin. Well, it's not quite Moses Sabrin, because Sabrin is also anglicized.
Absolutely. So my parents, being immigrants who wanted to have their children be anglicized, they changed our name to Sabrin. And my older brother was Joseph, so he kept his name. And my younger brother is Max. So they didn't have to change their name. I'm the only one that had a name change.
I think that was fairly common. My family, my mother's side, is entirely Armenian. And so we all have very foreign-sounding names, except one relative I had was curiously named Al Gardner. And I always loved Al Gardner. And I remember asking one day, why does Al Gardner have a curiously pronounceable name? They said, well, of course he wasn't born Al Gardner. He changed it to that so that he thought maybe he would assimilate better into the U.S. So apparently it's not that uncommon.
Well, today, of course, ethnic names are in.
Right, right, sure. You wouldn't be so inclined to do that today. So what was interesting to me in your story was how intellectually you came to be who you were, because you did not come out of the womb as a libertarian, but to watch how little episodes in your life, even as a young man, stuck with you so that when the full truth came to you, let's say, you were able to put those episodes into context and say, oh, okay, I remember this or that episode making me wonder about whether the government should do X or Y. So can you recall? Because it seems to me like your libertarianism came only, like you discovered Murray Rothbard on an airplane when the person next to you was reading a New York Times editorial or op-ed that was written by Rothbard. And that's how you found out about him.
Well, that's my first encounter with Rothbard. But if I go back a few years earlier, as an undergraduate history major, I was wanted to keep up with current events. So I subscribed to Newsweek. And I subscribed when Henry Hazlitt's column broke up into three columns by Henry Wallach, the Yale professor, Paul Samuelson from MIT, and Milton Friedman from University of Chicago. And I started reading them to get a sense of economics because I only took a couple economics courses as an undergraduate. And one column really struck me in 1966 when the minimum wage was debated. And Friedman wrote this column saying how the minimum wage is a racist piece of legislation because it doesn't allow young black, unskilled black kids to get a job because they're priced out of the market. And so that always stuck with me. I never pursued it. And then in 1969, a year after I graduated, I was in a bookstore in Syracuse, New York, and I came across Ayn Rand's book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. And that really got me going in terms of what was going on in the country. I'd already soured on the Great Society programs in the late 60s because I realized financially, they were not viable. And of course, the Vietnam War was a total disaster by the late 60s, the year before Johnson withdrew and Nixon won the election. So I read Rand. I started reading her publications. And of course, the famous article in there that Ron Paul talks about all the time is Alan Greenspan's article, Golden Economic Freedom, which really set the light bulbs off in my head about how the Federal Reserve inflated during the 1920s and caused the boom and then the bust. And then I learned from you and other people how Hoover and Roosevelt, Hoover started the New Deal, Roosevelt perpetuated it, and we got a decade-long depression.
I should actually go back, though, to when you were a little kid, because I kind of liked what you said about your father was just a very hard worker. You learned about hard work from a young age, but that he, even though you lived modestly, and I guess maybe the first place you lived, you shared a bathroom, he never thought of himself as living, quote, in poverty.
Right. We lived in a railroad apartment on East 8th Street in Lower Manhattan in the East Village, where a lot of immigrants from Europe who survived the Holocaust settled after World War II. And we had a first floor apartment with a big, I remember, big living room window facing the 8th Street. The living room was in the front. Then we had the kitchen with the bathtub in the kitchen, then a one bedroom. And we shared a bathroom in the hallway with a pull-down chain for the toilet, just like you saw in The Godfather, where Michael Corleone got the gun to kill the captain and mafioso rival. And so that was my first impression of being alive in Manhattan. And we didn't consider ourselves poor. My father was working in a pencil factory, making $1 an hour. The rent was $26 a month. And when we moved to the Bronx in 1953, a few months after my younger brother was born, and I entered second grade, I remember my father telling me, get an education and you'll become something in your life in America. He was a blue-collar guy, worked hard. then work two jobs, sheet metal worker during the day, cab driver in the weekends. And in the summertime, we spent, like many Jewish families at the time, in the Catskills to get fresh air and not have to deal with the heat and the humidity of New York City in the summertime. And so that was my mindset. Work, have some leisure activity in the summertime, and you'll have a decent life.
Was being Jewish in America ever an issue for you?
Oh, not at all. I mean, we lived in a very Jewish neighborhood in the West Bronx near the old NYU campus in University Heights, which is now the campus of Bronx Community College, where the famous Hall of Fame of Americans is located overlooking the Harlem River. It was a great experience. We would go there, play ball. The security of NYU would chase us to get off the property, which was not very neighborly of NYU, I must say, at the time in the 1950s and 60s. But we were allowed to walk on the campus. But if we played ball, they would chase us. And it was always a cat and mouse game between us and campus police back then. But it was a great neighborhood to live in. You could walk any time of day or night without any problems. And from there, my parents moved to Co-op City, which was built in the late 60s and the old Freedomland amusement park was. I got married in 68, and we moved to the Northwest Bronx at the foot of Riverdale, sort of the upscale part of the borough. And my wife and I lived there for 9 years until we moved to New Jersey in 1977.
When you were young, you got accepted into Bronx Science, I think, which is one of the most prestigious secondary schools in America. Like, only the cream of the crop are able to go there. What were you planning to, I mean, given that that was your background, what were you planning to study ultimately and devote your life to at that point?
That's a great question, because in eighth grade, was it eighth grade? Yeah, we're taking shop classes as you do in junior high school, different shop classes. And one shop class, I forget which one it was. What interested me is becoming an architect. I don't know how that came into my head, but living in New York City and seeing all these skyscrapers in the city, these magnificent architecture, I thought being an architect would be a really neat career choice.
Yeah.
And so in 10th grade at the Bronx High School of Science, which I was blessed to get in there because, like you said, at that time, it was the cream of the crop. There was no such thing as special privileges for anybody, especially a son of Holocaust survivors, to get into Bronx Science. These were the smartest kids in the city. I didn't consider myself that smart, but I was fortunate enough to get in. And in 10th grade, I took a mechanical drawing class, and I struggled with the class. I wasn't that good in doing the drawings. And I said, I don't think I'm going to be an architect. And then in junior high school, I decided to become a social studies teacher because I really loved history. I loved geography. One of my favorite gifts from my bar mitzvah in 1959 was a beautiful atlas that I read constantly to learn about the world we live in. And I started learning about all the regions of the world. And then when I was a undergraduate history major, I was a geography minor, and I took every regional course you could in geography. And same thing when I got my master's in social studies education. So I had a real appreciation of not only being an American, but being, quote, a world citizen, if you will, to use that phrase, of trying to learn how other people live, other cultures, languages. My father spoke 5 languages when he came to America. That gene didn't rub off on me, which I'm very, very disappointed, because he spoke some really tough languages. Of course, Polish was his native language, which was Yiddish, was the household language. Then he also spoke Russian, German, and Hebrew. Not exactly easy languages to learn. And when people came from Israel to visit, people we went through the war with, he would immediately speak Hebrew after not speaking it for years and years and years. He was just incredible with languages. And I just wish I had that same skill he did, because could you imagine knowing Spanish, Chinese, Russian, and God knows what other languages today? The opportunities would be endless in terms of the business world and the academic world.
Well, no doubt, no doubt. But you had, as this book shows, rather a charmed life all the same, even without that particular advantage. So you go to Bronx Science, eventually you go off to graduate school, where you're working on your PhD. And it turns out that you wound up getting inspired to pursue a particular topic for your PhD by reading Man, Economy, and State by Murray Rothbard. So what was that topic?
Well, this is interesting. I went up to the Foundation of Economic Education, picked up a whole bunch of Austrian books, including Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. And I was leafing through it while I was homesick with pneumonia in February of 1974, reading about his approach to money. And there's the topic right in front of my eyes. How money diffuses through society, the economy. And that was my dissertation topic, is how money diffuses through the U.S. economy and affects local economies. And that was my dissertation topic, which was that I think the first time someone ever did something like that is use applied Austrian economics to explain what was going on geographically in the U.S. economy during the inflation of 67 to 71.
Do you look back on that and think that was a real contribution? Or do you think it was something I did so I could get the piece of paper?
No, it was a contribution. Someone from the University of Chicago Geography Department asked to read my dissertation. I sent it to him, and he wrote me back this wonderful letter. I think I put some of that in my...
Yeah, that's kind of what I was feeding you with the question, because he wrote a beautiful thing to you about it.
I mean, I was really shocked to get that type of compliment from a University of Chicago professor who was one of the top geographers at the time. He said, this was a real theoretical breakthrough and empirical breakthrough for geographers to understand a very important economic concept, inflation, and how money is related to the whole concept.
Yeah, because of the idea of distribution effects, that the money is, we don't just assume away all the interesting questions by saying, let's just imagine that the money doubles overnight or something. That's not how it works anyway. So let's think about how it does work, which is that on the micro level, it makes its way from one place to another from the central bank. Now, what I didn't realize, I guess, maybe you told me, but I didn't realize that you were at the South Royalton Conference in 1974. Can you explain to people the significance of that event?
Well, what happened is I met Rothbard in person in April of 1974 when he was teaching at Brooklyn Polytech. And I think a week or two later, I got an invitation to go to this conference, an Austrian economics conference in South Royalton. I went there. I roomed with Joe Salerno, who was also at Rutgers at the time. We were both Rutgers graduate students. He was at the economics department. I was in the geography department. And Milton Friedman was there. Henry Hazlitt was there. I mean, all the luminaries, the young economists were there. The students of Mises were there. I mean, it was an incredible time in my life intellectually to meet all these great economists, young economists and established economists. And I just learned so much there. And my dissertation was already, topic was underway. And so I just kept on reading more and more and more. And it was really inspiring reading Hazlitt's work and all the other economists that are affiliated with the Austrian school. And I said, boy, this is just the proverbial kid in the candy shop, being a young graduate student, getting a chance to meet people who have had stellar careers in economics and just provided so much insight to young academics to really get their career underway.
I'm going to ask you something you might think is out of bounds, but that you can just feel free to tell me that. But you, not terribly long ago, after years of service to Ramapo College, endowed the Sabrin Center. Is it the Sabrin Center for Free Enterprise, something like that?
Correct.
Okay. Now, most people who spend their lives, 35 years as college professors, don't normally have enough of a nest egg to be able to pour that kind of dough into the college. So presumably you did something other than simply collect a salary as a professor of finance.
Well, one thing my parents taught us, including my in-laws, my mother-in-law and father-in-law, were great savers. And we saved a lot of our income over the years. And given the stock market, let it grow over time. And before you know it, you don't have to pay that endowment at one time. You pay it over several years. So that makes it a lot easier. And of course, the icing on the cake is that you get a tax deduction. So your taxes are reduced, which I would love to do in one of my proposals to increase charitable contributions to the country through the tax code. And I have a proposal for that, which I wrote about last week on my Substack column. So again, saving was ingrained in me, Tom, from literally being a youngster. And my mother was a great saver. I mean, she would clip coupons from the newspapers when she found out about it. She was told by a grocer, this is money. And she just didn't stop. And she just saved tons of money by using those coupons. And when she moved to New Jersey, where we live, she was teaching the young women there how to clip coupons to save money. And I don't know how much money she saved over her lifetime, but it's probably a huge ton. So we just kept on saving for our own income and just built up a nice nest egg to make these donations since we were both, my wife and I were both working and we were making decent salaries in 2007 and on. We were able to make this nice contribution. And as you know, we make contributions to the Mises Institute and Future Freedom Foundation and other nonprofits who I believe are doing great work, whether it's healthcare, economic education, or other activities.
Well, I stand corrected. Good for you. I'm glad you were able to do that. Because I thought maybe there was some chapter of your life where you were on Wall Street and maybe that didn't make it into the book or something like that. But Because I always assumed that about you, because you taught finance. I thought maybe you had had some portion of your career when you did that sort of thing full time, or at least on the side, and then you were an academic on the side. So, okay, I stand corrected.
Well, the thing is, a partner and I had an opportunity to market a product that this inventor created in northern New Jersey many years ago, and we couldn't reach terms, but it was a great product. It was a lubricant and a rust inhibitor, and it's better than WD-40, and it's not toxic. It's totally safe, and we just couldn't get to terms. But if we had gotten to terms, God knows how much money we would have made, because one of our early clients that we had when we were still on good terms with the inventor was the MTA, the Metropolitan Transport Authority, that used it for lubricant for their doors. And we could have got this into every subway system in the country, in the world. And God knows where that would have gone if we had stayed the course with the inventor, but he was very difficult to work with.
Hey folks, quick sponsor message via Woods here. Let me tell you something. With Christmas coming, there are a lot of gifts you can get people that they're absolutely going to hate. But there are fantastic and unique gifts that nobody else is going to get them, that they're going to love. Why not get one of those? And an excellent, excellent gift idea this Christmas is a big old box of Omaha steaks. The Woodses have been eating Omaha steaks for well over a dozen years. We love the convenience, the value, and the quality. Absolutely delicious, and what a great gift idea. The steak experts at Omaha Steaks have put together special curated gift packages that will help make you a Christmas hero. So go to omahasteaks.com and use code WOODS at checkout to get $30 off your order. Send an assortment of mouth-watering favorites guaranteed to impress, like the legendary Butcher's Cut Filet Mignon, air-chilled boneless chicken, ultra-juicy burgers. The burgers are ultra-juicy, and even easy-to-prepare comfort meals that are ready in a flash. Omaha Steaks is ready to ship your order right away, so shop early and beat the shipping rush. Go to omahasteaks.com and use promo code WOODS at checkout to get that extra $30 off your order. Minimum order may be required. I want to fast forward sort of toward the end, because you end this up in the late 90s, because you're talking about your gubernatorial run. So this is before the Ron Paul presidential campaigns, the U.S. Senate runs and things like that, which were the time when I got to know you. But in this gubernatorial race, you did well enough as the Libertarian candidate that you qualified for matching funds and you got into the debates with them. And you say in the book that you had never debated anybody before. And then suddenly you're debating a sitting governor and her challenger who was he from the state Senate?
State Senate and mayor. Double dipping in New Jersey was sort of a time-honored tradition for politicians back in the day.
Ah, okay, okay. Well, talk about that. I mean, I know at one point, closer to the end of the campaign, you got a call saying something to the effect of, look, if you just drop out and endorse Whitman, there could be a lucrative position for you, I think at a college or some kind of thing like that. What was that all about?
Yeah, this is a businessman who I met years earlier from a group of businessmen that would meet regularly to discuss the problems of the state. And they invited me because I knew several of the people there. And he calls me out of the blue one day. I'm sitting in my office at home. And he says, Murray, we have to stop McGreevy, the Democratic candidate, because he's just bad news. And I said, I'm in this race because I want to present libertarian solutions to the problems facing New Jersey, whether it's property taxes, auto insurance, and a whole host of other issues. And so he said, well, if you drop out, there could be something in for you. And I said, this campaign is not about me. I don't want anything about for me personally running for office. I want to present solutions. And so I said, forget about it. He said, we have a full page ad ready to run if you drop out. And so what I should have done is say, let me see the ad first, because I don't have anything except his word that this was coming from whoever told him to contact me. I have no idea who told him to contact me, but I said, forget about it. And one of my business people supporters knew him also. And he told this fellow who I called Fred in the book, forget about it. Murray's not interested in any of this. He's there to change policy in New Jersey to make life better for the people. And that was the end of that.
What was it like being in the debate? Did they give you less time than the other two?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, not only did they give me less time, but I think they were annoyed. They had to ask me questions, which I answered. One of the highlights of the campaign was when we discussed the speed limit in New Jersey, which was 55, by the way, at the time, when the New Jersey Turnpike was built for a 65 speed limit. So they asked Governor Whitman the question. They said, Governor Whitman, you support the 55 speed limit. Why? She said, well, New Jersey's a densely populated state, and therefore we need a 55 speed limit. It came to me to rebut, and I said, yes, Governor Whitman is right. We are a densely populated state, but nobody lives in the New Jersey Turnpike. And the place just broke up.
That's good. And you did get the 65 speed limit, ultimately.
Right after the election, I think 3-4 months after the election, she made the speed limit 65. Because the focus groups were saying the seniors wanted 55 speed limit. And of course, focus groups is what politics is all about in America. How can they find the soundbite that's going to give them more votes than anybody else? And of course, what happened, auto insurance was a big issue in 97. 4 years later, the Democrat, Jim McGreevy, gets elected. What does he do? He deregulates the insurance market like I proposed in 97, and auto insurance rates came down because more competition came in, like GEICO and other companies that stayed out of New Jersey because of the onerous regulations.
We don't want people to get confused here. This is not Gretchen Whitmer in Michigan. We're talking about Christine Todd Whitman in New Jersey. I don't remember much about her other than she struck me as the kind of Republican you would have to be to get elected in New Jersey.
Oh, no question about it. In fact, in the first 6 months of her administration back in 93, when she defeated Jim Florio, the sitting governor, barely, and she should have won by 10, 15 points, given all the taxes he imposed on the people of New Jersey, and she barely won that election, she sounded like a libertarian. Some of the rhetoric that was coming out of her office was just unbelievable. I said, if she keeps this up, she could have a shot to be a presidential candidate in 2000. Well, guess what happened in 2000? And I discussed this in the postscript. Namely, I rejoined the Republican Party in 1999 at the behest of the Republican Liberty Caucus. These are the libertarians within the Republican Party that want to make the Republicans more libertarian than they were. And so I rejoined the Republican Party and I announced for this U.S. Senate in 1999 to run against Lautenberg. He drops out. Whitman comes into the race, forms an exploratory committee. I'm watching her announcement on television on the evening news. And I say to my wife, given that I was so close to her in 3 debates, I said, I don't think she's going to run. Her body language suggests to me she's not into this race because I'm the only opposition. There were other candidates that were considering to run, but they were deferring to her. So several months later, on Labor Day 1999, she announces she's no longer going to seek the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate, just as I had predicted to my wife. And what happened is a few months before, according to her campaign manager, who is a very nice guy, he said, Murray, he was representing a new candidate at the time. He said, Murray, Christie dropped out because we did a poll and she was at 65% and I was at 35%. And we didn't want her to get beat up by you to run in the general election. Therefore, she dropped out of the race, which I thought was really bogus. Because if she really wanted to be a U.S. senator, then she should go for it, run against me. And going one-on-one with a sitting governor, even if I didn't win the election, win the primary, but came very close, that would be like Gene McCarthy almost winning the Democratic primary in February 1968 against Johnson when he got 42% of the vote. And Johnson dropped out the next month. So who knows what would have happened if she had stayed in the race and if I had come close. What, imagine if I had beaten her, Tom, where my stock would have been in the Republican Party in the year 2000.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. What made you go over to the Libertarian Party?
Well, I got a call March of 1997.
Oh, it was from the chairman of the party, actually, specifically. So how did you know him in the first place? I guess is kind of where I'm going. Or did he just know of you?
The chairman of the Republican Liberty Caucus. The National Republican Liberty Caucus. That was Clifford Thies from Pennsylvania, the finance and economics professor. He had known about me because I had spoken in Pennsylvania in the 90s when I was promoting my book, Tax-Free 2000. And so he knew about me and he called me out of the blue saying, Murray, you should rejoin the Republican Party so you can get these libertarian ideas into the Republican Party in New Jersey and hopefully into the United States Senate. Well, that didn't happen. My political career, as much as I tried, Tom, as you know, didn't pan out. And so I had this wonderful teaching career. And now in retirement, which I call TINSTAR, T-I-N-S-T-A-R, there's no such thing as retirement since I've written 4 books in 2 years since I retired in July of 2020. And my goal now is to get the libertarian message out to as many people as we can to really make libertarianism the solution to the issues facing the country, whether it's domestic policy or foreign policy.
Looking back on this period, which is a substantial chunk of your life, what would you do differently?
That's a great question. I've thought about that so many times, Tom. I can't tell you how many times I've thought about what would I have done differently. Given what I know now about academia and the business world, instead of going for a PhD, I probably would have gone for an MBA JD, a four-year program that would have given me a law degree and an MBA. And from there, you could teach college either law or something else. And then maybe I've gone on for a PhD in economic history, because I love economic history. I taught financial history of the United States, and using your material and other Austrian economists, students love the course because they learn so much about the evolution of the American economic and financial system that they just ate it up. It was probably the best reviews I've gotten as a professor in 35 years is that course, because students really got to know how Austrian economists analyze U.S. economic financial events, and they just got so much insight. Students still write me about how they love that course and what it meant to their academic careers and also their business careers. But an MBA JD plus a PhD over a 10, 15 year period from the time I graduated in 1968 would have, I think, changed my life enormously. And who knows where that have led. But still, I've had, I think, a wonderful academic career, got to meet as many people as possible in the business world, in the academic world, and of course, being in the political arena gave me some insight about politics that you don't find in the textbooks, Tom. I can tell you that.
No, I bet you wouldn't. I bet you have to learn those through hard experience. I was thinking just about productivity since retirement, because just the other day on Facebook, I saw that Alistair McIntyre, who's a philosopher, just gave a keynote address at a major conference. He's 93 and he's still out doing that. And everyone would understand if he decided, I think I don't feel like doing this anymore, you know, but yet there he is. For him, that's what retirement meant, is that, okay, now I have more time to do things that I enjoy. And one of them is being able to write and speak and this and that. But I do know that you and your wife for quite some time have been world travelers. So I know that you're not exclusively a workaholic.
Well, unfortunately, because of COVID, you have to be vaccinated to go on these tours now. And since all the research I've done about COVID, attending seminars, webinars, there's no way I'm going to get vaccinated. And my wife and I had to have a very robust discussion about vaccination. And so I said, there's no way I'm going to get vaccinated. And I had to convince her that vaccination is not the way to go to prevent COVID. And in the spring of 2020, as COVID was underway, I hosted a webinar with our friend, the late Robert Wenzel, and others, members of the legislature, medical people. And my friend and longtime naturopath suggested that we take all these supplements to prevent COVID, which, of course, people know about, vitamin D3, zinc, quercetin, cordyceps, resveratrol, whole bunch of things that builds up your immune system and your respiratory tract so you don't get COVID. And as they say, knock on wood, we've been fine for the 2.5 years or more that COVID's been around. Even though we've been in public, we don't wear masks in public here in Florida. And so traveling is really out of the question at this point, unless they change the requirement. But given my wife's health challenges over the last 18 months, which is not COVID related, it's going to be difficult to travel. But I would love to travel. There are about a dozen places that we had on our wish list to travel, but that probably will not happen because of these restrictions regarding vaccination.
It depends on how you want to travel, because if you don't need to go on an official quote-unquote tour, you can get into almost any country without vaccination now. The U.S. is one of the very, very few holdouts. In fact, I'm not even sure what other country other than the U.S. still requires it, because I've been traveling all over the place and no one has stopped me or asked me for anything.
Interesting. Well, right now, we would love to do more traveling of the United States. We've done very little U.S. traveling, but we've gone to every continent, Tom, around the world. We've gone to Antarctica. We've gone to Iceland. We've gone to Egypt. We've gone to China, we've gone to Australia, New Zealand, South America, Cuba. What a trip that was, Tom. And I've written about the Cuban trip. And one of the speakers talked about Ron Paul, by the way.
Oh, I love it.
I mean, and so I told him I represented Ron Paul in New Jersey in 2008 when he ran for president. He was thrilled. And so we talked about the embargo on Cuba and how this is an example of isolationism. It's ironic that Ron is an other libertarians are called isolationists because we don't want to intervene in the rest of the world, but having an embargo is not considered being an isolationist.
Right.
And he was, I think, deputy ambassador to the UN or something like that. He had a very high position in the Cuban government. And so he's well known in U.S. diplomatic circles, but it was great to meet these people in Cuba and see what was going on there. And they're changing, albeit slowly, but they're changing to a free market economy because people are entrepreneurial. They want to have the best of what's available. And to see the conditions in Cuba, where the state controls a good portion of the economy, is kind of sad.
I have this ridiculous bucket list idea that I came up with the other day, and it's completely pointless. It serves no purpose. But since I've been to 48 of the 50 states, and I'll probably get to number 49, the remaining ones are Oregon and Hawaii. And I think I'll probably get to Oregon sometime in 2023. I came up with this idea. I want to go to all 50 states and the territories, including the obscure ones. I want to go to the Northern Mariana Islands. I want to go to American Samoa. I want all of them. Now, there is no point in doing this. It is extremely logistically difficult to get to some of these obscure places. But I just feel like, I don't know, that places me in a very, very small elite if I accomplish that.
We were in Hawaii, I think, a couple times. We were in Alaska a couple times. I mean, Alaska was a great trip. I'd love to go back to Alaska. I mean, Alaska was just wonderful, especially in our summer here where it's so hot in Florida, to go to Alaska where it's much cooler. We were in the Arctic Circle. I mean, to see the midnight sun, it was incredible. And of course, Australia and New Zealand are just out of sight to see. I mean, incredible place. We were in Singapore, one of the great places in the world, Indonesia. I mean, we've traveled a lot in the last 30 years. And hopefully, with my wife's health improving, we can do some more traveling. But it's getting more and more of a pain in the neck at the airports. I know that. The TSA lines are just ridiculously long. And it's annoying, to say the least. But yeah, we did so much traveling the last 10 years before COVID that we were traveling twice a year to really exotic places. And that was our game plan once I retired, to travel at least twice a year. But we haven't traveled at all since our last trip, I think, was to Iceland, which, by the way, is totally open. And if you haven't been to Iceland, Tom, it's a great place.
Oh, I've got a trip scheduled for September of 2023 to Iceland, as it happens.
It's fabulous. I mean, everyone speaks English. Everyone seems to be 6 feet tall.
Oh, I'll fit right in then.
It's such a great history. I mean, it was just, I would go back in a heartbeat to Iceland because, first of all, it's not that far and the food is wonderful. We were there for Christmas and New Year's. It was really cold and dark. The sun doesn't come up till like 11 o'clock in the morning and sets at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So you got to get your vitamin D, and that's why they use castor oil a lot to get the vitamin D and A in, because you can really be vitamin deficient in Iceland very easily. But the people are wonderful. They have some wonderful clothes there, by the way, also. We picked up a few things there. This is the thing about being an academic. And if you have a curiosity, you really want to know how people live around the world. And why, to use an old phrase, why we all can't get along is beyond me, since I don't have any beefs with the Chinese. I don't have a beef with the Russians. But yet our governments are constantly in conflict. And this is the great conundrum that we're facing around the world.
Yeah, I hear you. And I was worried that I wouldn't be able to travel anymore. So I've actually been kind of surprised at how rapidly these restrictions on quote-unquote unvaccinated people have been repealed, because I thought unvaccinated people, especially in another country coming to visit yours, are not part of anybody's political constituency. Why would I care what if unvaccinated people in Portugal are unhappy with me? It doesn't matter to me if I'm an American politician. Well, of course, in the US, they haven't reversed that. But the UK reversed it very quickly and suddenly. Like all of a sudden, forget what we just said. You can all just come in. I didn't see that coming.
Well, I think their tourism numbers must have plunged.
Yeah, it must have been awful. Yeah.
I mean, and so many businesses are dependent upon tourism. In fact, we met a couple in the gym today who are going back to Australia for their sixth visit. And they want to see the people that they toured with, but they can't because they were out of work for 2 years. And so they're working in other industries. I mean, this is how destructive COVID has been to the world economy. It's just an incredible blot on the political world that they've destroyed so many people's lives, businesses, and mental attitude. We all know the stories of anxiety and depression going through the roof the last 2.5 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I assumed was, it doesn't have to be a majority, but if enough of us just refuse to do this, I'm not going to go to this venue if it's going to make this requirement of me, I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to do that. A lot of these places are operating on very narrow profit margins as it is. And then to have suddenly an arbitrary chunk of people just not attend anymore, I thought that had to mean that ultimately we would win this. And it looks like at least in the short run, we have, by and large, with some holdouts.
Oh, there's no question about it. We know from history, Tom, and you're a great student of history and a great teacher of history, governments overreach. We've seen this time and time again. And when they overreach, unfortunately, people get hurt. And then you get, as they say, the revolt of the masses. And we've seen it time and time again. And I think we're seeing it again to a certain extent.
Well, Murray, I want to urge people to check your book out. Of course, I will have it linked on our show notes page, which is tomwoods.com/2248, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story, about Murray Sabrin and his experiences coming to the United States. One last thing. Of course, it's much easier learning a new language when you're young. You're a spring chicken as opposed to later in life. So age 2.5, is that still young enough that you were able to just absorb English and it was no problem? Or because I'm curious about that.
Yeah, I was bilingual until I was 8 years old. I mean, I spoke to my parents in the home language, which was Yiddish. When I was in Germany, my parents had a nanny and she spoke to me in German, my father told me, and I understood that. So kids are sponges, as you know, Tom, with your family. Kids can learn so much at a young age. They can be bilingual, they can be trilingual. And that's the beauty of the human experience, is that kids are natural learners. And if we just allow that to happen, kids can soar, not to use a cliche. It's just that the schools stifle them terribly. And that's why I look at my own experience and I said, I just naturally remember speaking English and Yiddish at home with my parents, going back and forth in each language seamlessly. And my father and my mother, when they didn't want us to know, they would speak Polish. And my father would speak Hebrew when his friends came over. And Russian, I never heard them speak Russian, but my father was fluent in Russian also. I mean, that's why I'm just amazed at these immigrants that come from Europe and they can speak three languages seamlessly and without any effort. And then they come to America in their 20s and 30s and 40s and learn English without a problem. So it's just amazing how human beings are adaptable and they're just very smart people.
Yeah. And you had great opportunities. It's just that when you're really young, like really, really young, and you're really poised to be able to learn languages, you don't have the maturity. Your brain isn't developed enough yet to realize the importance and the value of this. And then you get older and you say, oh, I wish I spoke all these languages. And you can try, but it's really, really laborious to pick it up later in life. Or playing the piano. Jeez, I wish I had realized when I was 8 that I'm really going to be happy that I can play the piano later in life. You know, and you can't, you've got all this energy and mental ability, but you can't see the big picture yet. When your parents try to talk you into it, you're going to be happy that I forced you to play the piano. No, I won't. But yes, you will. Yes, you will. But I, unfortunately, I didn't do any of these things. I didn't learn languages when I was young. I didn't learn musical instruments when I was young. So that's okay. I benefit from other people's knowledge of these things.
Well, that's why the division of labor is such a beautiful concept.
Yes.
Specialization. I mean, it's just what makes the world really tick. I mean, there are people that are really good at a lot of things. There are people that are good only at a few things. And we have this great civilization, except the politicians are really undermining it with really dumb and destructive policies. And I hope this book is an inspiration to young people to say, hey, we can do a lot better than what we have today. And let's go out and create jobs and nonprofits and be productive instead of whining about what's going on in America. And I want to congratulate you on your School for Life. I think it's a magnificent achievement.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Murray. All right. Well, again, tomwoods.com/2248 is where you can find Murray's new book. And then do you have something else that's either on the way or out already? What's your next thing?
This is very exciting, Tom. The Kindle edition of my autobiography will be available free on Amazon on December 7th, 9th, 12th, 14th, and 16th, 5 days. You can get the ebook free. This is my birthday gift to the American people, since I have a birthday coming up in, 16 days. And the first day of winter is my birthday. And so I want to give a gift to the American people because America has been very good to me and the Sabrin family. And you can get the ebook, buy the paperback. The publisher has priced it at an incredibly low price in order to make sure that people can get it for themselves and give it as gifts for Christmas and Hanukkah and whatever other occasion is coming up, New Year's, whatever. I'm hoping this book is read by people and they can learn how you don't have to have that silver spoon in your mouth. You just have to have good values and you can achieve a lot in America.
Well, that's the lesson of the Murray Sabrin book and life. So congratulations on releasing the book. Congratulations on living it, because it certainly sounds like you did so many of the right things. And I've been very happy to support you and your work over the years. So check out tomwoods.com/2248. And we'll talk to you again soon, Murray. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom. You take care now.
All right, folks, that is another episode of the Tom Woods Show. I will see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.